difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Scott Tobias,
and Genevieve Kosky.
On last week's show, we talked about Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean's 1962 classic about old school desert power and the Arab tribes in World War I who banded together to fight, either under the heroic, larger than life but secretly troubled leadership of the British Colonel T.E. Lawrence, or with him as just sort of a helpful liaison in the war they were already fighting, depending on who's telling that story. The leadership in Frank Herbert's 1965 sci-fi novel Dune follows a similar course, but without the tension of a real-life figure to contradict some of the fictionalized epic. Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 1 starts the process of adapting the novel, taking its time in introducing a struggle between powerful families and a far-flung space opera imperium, leading to a war that all but wipes out one of them. Timothée Chalamet stars as Paul Atreides, the son and heir of a clan leader who's been ordered to take control of a crucial and profitable planetary outpost that produces spice, a powerful hallucinogen that enables space travel. But the Emperor is deliberately setting Paul's family against the powerful Harkonnen tribe, who have controlled the spice world for 80 years and don't want to let it go. This movie is just the first half of the story, which, we should note, was made with no sign of the second half having been greenlit, so we have no idea as of this recording whether Villeneuve will get the chance to complete his story. But given how Herbert's novel was inspired by Lawrence's life and work, there are some strong resemblances here, which we'll lay out after we take a moment to take in the sweep and scale of the half of the story that we did get. We'll talk about desert power and a different kind of messiah myth-making after this break.
Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known. What's to become of our world? Paul.
A boy.
Hey, Duncan, can I trust you with something?
Yes, always, you know that.
I've been having dreams about a girl on Arrakis. I don't know what it means.
Dreams make good stories. But everything important happens when we're awake.
Hey, you, put on some muscle?
I did?
No.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
Smile, Gurney.
I am smiling.
The Emperor asks us to bring peace to Arrakis. House Atreides accepts!
I know you. There's something awakening in my mind.
You need to face your fears.
Come with me.
So what did everybody think of Dune, a.k.a. Dunk, a.k.a. Dune Part 1?
I really liked it a lot. And the thing about it was like, I had never read the book until I read it this summer. You know, and I, of course, I'd seen the Lynch film and been somewhat baffled by it. but thinking again, it's just, this is not adaptable. You can't do this. And to see this film articulate the book as clearly and as purposefully and with the kind of like scale that this one did, the impeccable casting, I just thought it was kind of a miracle of a movie, or at least miracle of a half movie. And I found it kind of overwhelming, almost to the point where I'm kind of needing to see it again to see what it's about, because I'm just kind of impressed that it functions as well as it does, that it feels not rushed in the way that the Lynch film does, that it feels graspable in every bit of character and intrigue that's in it, and that it has this really detailed realization of a pretty fantastical world that Frank Herbert had created. So I liked it quite a bit.
Me too. I went into it. I had high hopes, and knowing full well that it's a really hard book to adapt. One might even say impossible, although you could say impossible, except it was done pretty successfully with this. It's a nice, smooth piece of storytelling. Visually, it's completely overwhelming and striking. The Villeneuve tone, the sort of like, I don't even know how you describe it, but it's sort of like, there's kind of a hypnotic quality to what he does that's on full display here. And I think it's really well cast too. I think this was a smart casting all around, although I didn't realize till the credits it was Stellan Skarsgård, or I'd forgotten at least as Baron Harkonnen. He's under a lot of makeup, but I was thinking, whoever that guy is, doing a good job.
Whoever that makeup artist is, doing a better job.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the performances, because, or in just the casting, I should say, because I think, you know, sort of, it's obviously not an ensemble piece. Like, it's very much about Paul Atreides. I still can't get over that he's named Paul. I know that this is like a very basic thing to say.
Jessica seems more Paul, basic than Paul.
Yeah, Paul and Jessica. Yeah. Speaking of, Rebecca Ferguson was probably my favorite part mm-hmm. of the film by a pretty large measure, although I did like the film pretty much overall. You know, I have some nitpicks here and there, but I also like, I have very little connection to Dune, like, as an entity. I haven't read the book. I haven't seen the Lynch film. My husband loves Dune. Like, he was very, very excited to see this film, and he really, really loved it as a fan of the book and the property in general. So, you know, I think the fact that it can be satisfying, whether or not you bring that knowledge into it, is reflective of the storytelling, you know, being pretty efficient, as Keith points out, but also there is a sort of reverence for the details, or the sort of, I don't want to call it fan service, but just the texture of the story that fans have gravitated to, and the specifics of the characters. Yeah, so I like Dune. I'm eyeing Tasha's window because I keep seeing her nose scrunch.
Well, I want to ask one question of Genevieve before we get to Tasha, which is the movie as clearly articulated as I think it is? Because I had read the book, and so all of it was mm-hmm. kind of clear to me. But as someone who hadn't encountered this story or read this book, did you have trouble following it?
I mean, the story itself is a pretty basic, like, chosen one narrative. I mean, there's obviously, like, this sort of tribal battle happening between the different houses, you know, and probably the most difficult thing for me as, you know, a non-reader to get my head around was just, like, what things were called, you know, because while you have Paul and Jessica, you also have Bene Gesserit,
Bene
Gesserit.
Bene Gesserit, yeah. Which, when someone just says it, you're like, wait, what is what? Bleh? You know, there's a lot of sort of like terms like that that kind of, you know, without the subtitles, which I think as I've brought up semi recently on here, have become maybe a little too dependent on with home viewing. Some of that was, you know, maybe kind of flew over my head on the first three or four references. But by the end of the film, I was like, okay, I get it. They're Order of Witches, you know. You know, and it does have that opening narration, which funnily enough, Steve missed. He was getting refreshments and got caught in a line. So he missed all the opening exposition, but obviously he didn't need it. But I think, but I obviously did. So yeah, now I knew what spice was, and I'm good to go.
did you enjoy the gom jabber? This is the box he puts his hand in.
The gom jabber is the needle,
right? What's the name of the box he puts his hand in? Is there a name for that? I can't recall.
Pain.
In the tradition of Paul and Jessica, it's just called the box.
The box. Yeah. Okay.
What's
okay.
In
so
the
now,
box?
now, I feel like Tasha's about to bring the hammer down on this whole thing.
I just hammered for days. That is entirely what I'm here for, is the hammering. Now, this, I went in as blank on expectation as I possibly could, because a lot of my coworkers at Polygon had already seen it out of earlier screenings at film festivals or in New York, and they were really divided on it. I mean, this has been a polarizer for sure. And we're seeing the exact same polarization in, critics, basically. Film Twitter is having one of its "we're all at the same party and we're all glaring at each other and refusing to speak to each other" parties over Dune, where some people absolutely despise this movie and some people are all in. So I went in just kind of like, let's approach this as tabula rasa as you can for something where you've read the book and seen a previous goofy ass adaptation multiple times and are forever scarred by the image of Sting prancing around in Hawkman underoos with his entire body
oiled. Scarred the word? Scarred or intrigued?
You know.
Changed, transformed.
Changed forever. Let's just put it that way. I really enjoyed this movie a lot. And it's so pretentious. It's so airless. It's so humorless that I found myself like, as it was... Y'all had your blah blah. Let me have my moment. I found myself like half an hour in kind of thinking, why am I enjoying this so much? Like, why am I so absorbed? I know how every beat of this story is going to go. Why am I feeling so much tension? And I think in the end, maybe it's because I think one of the big flaws of Lynch's version of Dune is that it feels like it's full of space aliens. Like in a sense, these are all space aliens, and you know, things like the Guild Navigators are more space alien-y than other things. But Villeneuve's Dune honestly feels like it's about human beings, like recognizable, familiar, accessible human beings in space. And they have, you know, problems with pride and loyalty and duty and fear that are familiar. They're blown out to space operatic size, but they're recognizable. The people in this movie are recognizable in a way that the people in the previous Dune, and to some degree, even the people in the book weren't recognizable to me. So I think the casting is great, but also I love the texture of this movie. I love the look of the ships and the settings, the layout of the sort of, you know, castle fortress on Arrakis where the Atreides come to land, the way Caladan, the planet, is visually differentiated from Geti Prime where the Harkonnen live, which that kept tripping me up because it's Harkonnen in the Lynch Dune and Harkonnen in this version. And it's about the only thing that's really different in terms of pronunciation. So it was a weird thing. But anyway, I just really enjoyed this movie. And when it became clear that it was wrapping up, I kind of felt a loss. I was like, no, I know where we're going from here, and I want to see what you do with it. Genevieve mentioned the little details that might be considered fan service. And for me, there's a moment on Caladan when the Atreides are waiting for the herald of the emperor to make the announcement that they're headed to Arrakis. And they're standing there with Thufir Hawat, the Mentat, who is kind of a human calculator. And Baron Leto, Paul's father, played by Oscar Isaac, turns to him and asks him a calculating question. And Thufir's eyes go white, like his pupils roll up into his head, and he pronounces the information about like what this trip would have cost based on calculations in a very affectless, almost robotic voice. And I found myself just thinking, like, this is a choice in a movie that's full of tiny, detailed choices. Somebody paused to think about like what it would mean to be a human calculator and like how a calculator injection into the brain would differ from like the ordinary interactions with this person. And I just found myself like throughout the movie noticing like all of these little details and little choices that make a world distinctive, that make a science fiction world different and interesting, but layered on top of all of these people that actually felt like people.
That's Steve McKinley Henderson as Thufir Hawat, by the way, who's one of my actors. I'm always really happy when he shows up. I love that guy.
And it was a Lady Bird reunion between him and Timothée Chalamet. It was.
So, I mean, I don't know. Are there, apart from only getting half of the story, are there downsides to this movie? It sounds like we all perfectly liked it. I mean, it's
potentially a big downside. It really feels like you should get about a 15-minute intermission and then come back and watch part two, a la Lawrence of Arabia. I feel like, you know, looking at the you know, by the time this comes out, it'll already be decided. But, you know, looking at the tracking numbers, it looks like it's going to be relatively successful. I think it's successful enough to warrant a part two. But you know, I kind of hate that for a while the talk was like, yeah, don't even bother because it's not going to be part two. Yeah. If there is no part two, I'll be, you know, very disappointed. But I think there's no reason not to see this just because of that. There's a lot to appreciate and enjoy here.
I will say I've been a little exasperated throughout the pandemic with, you know, people doing the, especially directors doing the, well, you have to see this movie in a theater, you haven't really seen it thing. And Villeneuve was on that list. And given, you know, the relative safety of watching movies at home and the obvious convenience of watching movies at home, I've been a little prickly, like listening to directors be pushy about this. But this is a movie that I saw on an IMAX theater screen. And my thought coming out of it was, I would not have wanted to see this any other way. And I'm not sure people who see it at home on HBO Max on day of release are really seeing this movie.
Tasha, we were chatting on the Zoom about this before you got on, but I think I do want to watch this movie. I'm very glad I saw it in the theater, even though I saw it in a theater that made me very uncomfortable. No one was masked. It was very crowded. It was upsetting. But, you know, also, but like wearing my mask through the whole movie, I felt like it just kind of like kind of contributed to the feeling, you know, of like it's like my little still suit. But but I will say, like, I do want to see this movie again. Hi. Like, this is a movie that I would like to see stoned. And I didn't because I knew I'd be talking about it for this film. And I don't do that. But, you know, a movie that just like is this visually stimulating. I think if you are a person who gets down with watching movies like that from time to time, like it's an exciting prospect for me to watch it that way. But I think probably the home viewing experience is probably a little better for that particular combination. So, but I'm glad I saw it in the theater first, but I am going to do that at some point.
though, you know what? I will say, you know, there are different ways that things can kind of break in terms of how you might go about directing Dune. And I think I've said this a million times, but I'm going to say it again. It's like, you know, it is a book that kind of requires somebody, you know, a combination of a George Lucas and Alejandro Jodorowsky, somebody who has a good sense of the classical sort of hero's journey, and also somebody who can deliver kind of a hallucinogenic freak out. Yeah. And there's not a lot. Villeneuve is not a hallucinogenic freak out kind of guy. I mean, and I don't think this film is completely square. It's very earnest. But yeah, I mean, I think there might be even an even trippier version of Dune that this is not, that would like lend itself to more to recreational drug use than the one we actually have.
Well, sure. I'm not going to litigate whether or not this would be good to watch high. But the answer is yes.
I will say the podcast is pivoting, Keith. Legalization is really, it's opening up a door for us.
This is your next highest picture show.
but I will say there is an entrancing film. Yeah. I find narratively it kind of swept along. But even if the narrative wasn't entirely working, I think the visuals would be and the sort of tone of the film and the score, the Hans Zimmer score. I love it. You know, I heard some grousing about it before I'd heard anything about, you know, I'd heard a note of the score itself, and I actually think it's one of his best scores. It's wonderful stuff.
I listened to it on the way home. I was like, yes, I want to hear more of this. Tasha, you kind of like raised if there was like stuff that didn't work so well for us, or no, we were talking about sort of the perils of chopping it into two parts like this. And I think that the Zendaya sequences are kind of undercut by being, they're obviously a preview of what's to come. Mm-hmm. Although as I understand it, his visions are not necessarily, you know, what will actually happen. He's just seeing possibilities, correct?
And metaphors, it seems, based on some stuff that actually does happen, it seems like he's getting sort of interpretations of things that will happen rather than literal.
That character, Chani, like, she's a much bigger part in the second part of this story, I'm assuming, right? So,
it is a lot of carefully paced build up for something that we mostly don't get in this movie.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of like comparisons to the Zendaya scenes as like perfume commercials, you know, interspersed throughout, which is obviously a glib way to put it. But I don't want to call it like a fault of the film, because I think it's like the way the film is built. But it is maybe sort of a little bit of a ding against it as far as the splitting it into two parts.
I really do feel like he's doing a lot of thematic and symbolic build up for things that we haven't yet gotten the payoff yet. And if people don't get to see the second part for 2 years, like some people are obviously going to rewatch part one immediately beforehand. But, you know, it is a little bit like reading a Game of Thrones book and then expecting like when in 7 or 8 or 10 or never years when the next one comes out, you'll be able to kind of like pick up on who the characters are and where they are.
Yeah. Though I will say in the Lynch film, Sean Young, who plays the Zendaya character in that film, just does not show up early in that movie. And actually, I think the Lynch film, I think there's only like 45 minutes left in the Lynch film where this one leaves off.
There is a real like, oh crap, we got to finish this story quality. Oh,
that's the thing about the Lynch film. It's like he does all the cool Lynch stuff right away, and it's just like, oh crap, I can't kind of screw around anymore. I actually have to like squeeze this entire book into the rest of the movie, and then the movie just feels incredibly rushed. I mean, that's really such a chief pleasure of this film for me, is just the clarity and the pace of the storytelling is so impossible almost, but it works. I mean, just like you just like, okay, that's Dune, like that's the book I read, and this has been realized with such sharpness and such purposefulness. I was kind of stunned by that. It's just a very basic thing, and again, it's not something I do wonder about the why of it. I do wonder about the themes of the film, and whether I'm going to find on repeat viewings that Villeneuve has a specific take on Dune like Lynch might have had, or certainly as Jodorowsky would have had, that I'm going to connect to. But just the meat and potatoes of it, just of the world building and of the storytelling, pretty peerless.
I want to get into the themes in a second, but and we're definitely going to get deep into the themes when we start talking connections, because there's a lot there. But just in talking about the pace of the movie, I have to say my one big gripe with this film is it takes so much time and space with so much of the story in a way that I think really serves it well, that really gives you a sense of the scale and lets you get to know the characters in a meaningful way. And then for some reason, the setup makes it feel like the Atreides are on Arrakis for about 15 minutes before the Harkonnens make their move. And it feels a little weird to me. That part of the movie feels rushed in the way that the Lynch film felt rushed. And I'm not sure why. It seems like we needed, I guess, a little more of a gap where the Atreides settled in on the planet. So it wouldn't feel, I mean, yes, obviously the intrigue here is basically, hey, the Emperor set you up. But, you know, the book is packed with intrigue, and it stretches out and takes a while. And like here we kind of cut straight to the chase. You know, it's pretty much a, by the way, this is going to be trouble. Oh, wait, nope, it's trouble. It's trouble right now. Yeah. There's not much of a breather.
Yeah, there's no real like anticipation of the trap being sprung. Like it just springs immediately. But
I don't want to weigh that down, because there's so much I do love about the movie. But I think want to get into it sounds like Scott doesn't have an answer for this and is aware of it. For the other two of you, do you have a sense for what Villeneuve finds important here? With Arrival, I felt like I understood what he was trying to communicate in terms of the difficulties of communication, in terms of the ideas behind language and what makes an alien alien. But here, I feel like he's respecting the source material greatly. He's thinking through the visual textures of everything. But I'm not sure I have a sense yet for why he wants to do Dune, what he feels is important about this story or about these people.
Well, I think thematically, the fact that it opens with Chani, Zendaya's character, talking about basically talking about colonialism, talking about imperialism and how her people have suffered under it, I don't think that's insignificant. And I suspect that is the fact that it's not fleshed out all that much is owing in large part to this being part one of an unfinished story. And the second part, we'll get into that. But, you know, I do feel like that the opening of this film kind of lays down a marker as to what part one and part two together are one thing that's going to concern them quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think maybe sort of an attendant theme or interest is just the idea of what constitutes power or strength. Timothée Chalamet is a very slight person, you know, as far as like big screen heroes go. You know, he doesn't come across as an imposing or powerful figure, and especially when you have him next to like a Jason Momoa and a Josh Brolin and like just massive interstellar firepower, and not just Paul, but the Fremen, and you know how they are able to control and navigate this landscape in a way that is like completely different compared to like how the Imperium, you know, navigate and dominate this landscape and, you know, the limitations of that. I think there's just sort of a consideration of sort of like hard power versus soft power or however you want to delineate that. And I think probably that feeds into maybe ideas about colonialism and imperialism that the film is maybe building toward in the second part.
Building toward is a key couple of words, I think, because this does feel like it is setting the table for something for more to come. I mean, I think in terms of like a lot of the, you know, really intense discourse that may happen over this film is going to maybe happen over the second half, not the first, in terms of just Paul's immersion into the world of the Fremen, about, you know, the possibilities, the darker possibilities that go along with that journey. I mean, I think that stuff is hinted at here, but maybe something that he'll follow through on in a much bigger way in part two.
We should talk a little bit about the casting, which is both very multi-culty and I think aimed in some way at some of these messages about colonialism and imperialism. The Atreides are pretty white people. You know, Oscar Isaac is of Guatemalan descent, but he's still pale compared to like the Fremen, for instance. But the Fremen aren't like a monoculture. They don't appear to have anything linking them in terms of like skin color or, you know, facial features. They're a wide variety. But they're a variety of specifically people of color, and they contrast pretty sharply with particularly Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica, and just the body of the Bene Gesserit in general, who, from what we see, all appear to be extremely pale women who have an extreme amount of power to manipulate, among other things, what the Fremen believe and how they act. There's also a character here who's been gender and race swapped. Liette is given, I think, a kind of a bigger role than in either the Lynch version or from what I remember of the book. It's a pretty significant role, and she's played by Sharon Duncan Brewster in this version of the movie. So there's certainly a lot of thought and attention being given to kind of the racial composition here. What did you guys think of the casting, either on that basis or just in terms of like there's some very familiar faces here in these roles?
I think the casting up and down is pretty great. I mean, I again, an experience of reading the book and then not really knowing anyone other than Chalamet being in the movie, just kind of looking at Wikipedia to see who they cast at all the roles and being like, wow, that seems about right for just about every single one. And even Chalamet, who may seem like a kind of an odd build, I guess, for someone to be a hero, is very much, I think, in keeping with Herbert's description of who Paul is, as being this sort of lithe, introspective kid, really, you know, who's also uncanny in a way that Timothée Chalamet can project really, really well. So I thought that's well cast, and there's a lot of just flavorful performances in this too. Javier Bardem being one of them. I think Charlotte Rampling's one scene as the Reverend Mother is just phenomenal. So I think it's up and down, really well cast.
I like the Chalamet casting a lot. You're looking for Harry Potter, not Arnold Schwarzenegger, with this character. You know, someone who's kind of somewhat unlikely, but as you say, charismatic in some interesting ways.
Yeah, I when I said that he, you know, doesn't necessarily look like someone that you would consider to be in this role, like I understand that I say that understanding that, like, this is what Paul as a character is. I just mean in terms of, like, someone who is destined to save the universe. Although I guess, like, maybe the Harry Potter comparison also works there.
But it makes it fun with Jason Momoa, though, right?
I was just going to bring up Jason Momoa because I think he and Javier Bardem, who you mentioned, Scott, are maybe the only sources of humor in this film. Yeah, like maybe Josh Brolin has a laugh line, but for the most part, like Jason Momoa, I think, is like sort of like the charismatic center. And I, as I understand it, Duncan Idaho is sort of maybe a bit of a fan favorite character as well. So I really like Jason Momoa. I'm kind of just a sucker for him in general, although I did have a little, did take me a minute to get past him not having a beard here. He has a surprisingly baby face under that very distinctive beard of his. So, but yeah, I really enjoyed that character and that performance, as well as Javier Bardem, who, you know, appears sort of early in the film. And there, I think, is where he kind of gets his, like, laugh moments when he is interacting with Oscar Isaac's character and spitting at him and whatnot. You know, when he reappears later in the film, I think he is, you know, a much more sort of forceful presence. But it works both ways because he's Javier Bardem.
Yeah, I think Jason Momoa kind of has the corner on, like, warm charisma in this movie. There's a ton of cold charisma, but it's interesting to me that they make time for him repeatedly hugging people in this movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a movie that where almost everybody seems to be about, like, standoffish dignity, he drops dignity in favor of warmth. And he's great. He's a standout. I think it's great casting. But I also really appreciate Dave Bautista as the Beast Raban, who I hope we get more of in the second film, because, you know, you don't cast Dave Bautista to be in the background anymore. Like, he is a leading man these days, and he's got a lot of presence for a role that hasn't really asserted itself yet. So I'm hoping that we get part two and that we get more of him, because it feels like he could really bring something to, again, a role that didn't necessarily entirely get its due in the previous version.
This is quite a time for charismatic, beefy guys in movies. There's like so many of them now. John Cena and The Rock and everybody, they're all beefy and fun.
I thought Rebecca Ferguson made interesting choices as Lady Jessica. I'm not sure that I love how weepy she is as kind of the lead female in this. She is definitely a much more vulnerable interpretation of that character. And it does kind of make her more accessible. It drives empathy, but it also makes her seem like kind of the weak link in a long chain of very hard people who need to be very hard to survive. And, you know, it's not that she lacks hardness, and it's not that she doesn't get action scenes or get to agency or get to do her own thing. But, you know, she is much more vulnerable out there in the open emotionally than anybody else in this film. And it, I don't know, maybe itched at me a little bit.
I think that will change, though. I think the arc of that character is someone who I recall from the book, her being absolutely just horrified by, you know, the Reverend Mother coming and him having to put his hand in the box or whatever, and her being extremely emotional about that moment. But then also her having to follow an agenda that is separate from Paul's, ultimately, you know, that she's not going to be completely, you know, that there's going to be an inevitable estrangement there and some colder choices that she's going to have to make later. So maybe I'm guessing that when this thing is completed, that maybe we might see that performance slightly differently.
You know, that's a possibility. And it just, like, it leads me into all sorts of things I want to talk about in terms of things that might happen or might be brought to light. I don't think it's maybe the wisest move to start spoiling a movie maybe a literal year or two before it's made, let alone released. So we'll close out with this. Scott, if they just don't greenlight part two, are you going to explode?
Yeah, I will. I'm already preparing my to be a internet troll on a release the Snyder Cut level scale. So yeah, it would break me if part two did not get made, I would be very upset.
But what if it comes out and it's like It Part Two, and everything you liked about the first one is kind of retroactively spoiled?
Yeah,
I have more faith in Denis Villeneuve than I think.
I do as well. No, the film filled me with confidence that he knew what he was doing. So fingers crossed on that.
Well, there's honestly a ton more to talk about, but I think a lot of it is going to come out when we start looking at the connections between Dune and Lawrence of Arabia. So we'll be right back after this break to do exactly that.
They were pointing at us. What are they shouting?
Listen, Al-Ghaib. Voice from the outer world. It's their name for Messiah. That means the Bene Gesserit have been at work here.
Planting superstitions.
Preparing the way, Paul. These people have waited for centuries for the Lizan al-Ghaib. They see you. They see the signs.
They see what they've been told to see.
We're good to go.
So now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about everything they have in common. Where do we even want to start?
Very long list in front of us.
It's a very long list. It's not a list we're necessarily going to hit everything of. I feel like we can't jump into this discussion without talking a little bit about the white savior motif in both of these movies. Like, you do fundamentally in Dune have a group of outcasts who live in the desert who are modeled after Arab tribes, who are modeled after the groups seen in Lawrence of Arabia, and this very pale, very young person who has been set up for decades, if not centuries. It's unclear how far back the plan reaches, but has been set up as a messiah figure. The Fremen have literally been conditioned over time, sociologically brainwashed into seeing everything he says and does as a sign that he is the messiah. So you have this, you know, very young, very skinny, very untried youth who's suddenly, you know, going to be lording it over people who are much more experienced, especially in the realm and the type of fighting that they do, and who have this unstoppable fighting force. You have the same thing in Lawrence of Arabia, where this man who's untested in the ways of the desert comes out to it and just immediately starts saying, well, I'm going to do it the way you do it, and immediately impresses everybody. He's a little bit of a Mary Sue. He kind of rolls in, and everybody like bristles at first and then falls in love with him. And both of them are kind of destined to like lead these people out of what's kind of portrayed as a more backwards way of life into like a larger world, by which both of these movies kind of mean the larger world of like white people and their white people politics. How do we navigate these things in both of these movies?
With difficulty.
With difficulty and discomfort to some degree, I think.
So, I mean, with Dune, I think we're talking a little bit about part two, which we can't really do. But I feel like with both of these, they're not unquestioning. I think the as sort of exemplary a white savior narrative as Lawrence of Arabia is in many ways, it's also already, I think, questions about it are kind of baked into the narrative of it as well. And I think Dune expands on that as well. Although, again, we're mostly talking about things we can't quite talk about yet.
And with Lawrence of Arabia, I do have to come back again to that scene of him in the robes, and just the robes in general, you know, these voluminous white robes that he is bestowed as a, you know, a sign of acceptance, but are also very messianic, you know, visually speaking. But also, you know, they don't really quite fit him. You know, when he gets those robes, he's immediately come upon by this Arab who's like, what the hell is going on? Like, what do you think you're doing? One of my like favorite just little details, like visual details in Lawrence of Arabia that kind of fits under this heading is, you know, the first time we see him in the desert, the first time we see him on a camel, I think Keith noted how he's like, seems like very little boy and happy about it. I was very focused on the fact that he has like his shirt sleeves rolled up and his forearms exposed to the desert, his pale forearms exposed to the desert sun, which is just like, feels like such a symbol of how unfit he is for this environment. But, you know, I think to the actual question about, you know, how the films engage with white saviorism. I think, as Keith says, Lawrence of Arabia is not ignoring it. It is not also not necessarily like trying to deliver a verdict, or, you know, I think it just sees it as part of the complicated fabric of T.E. Lawrence and the band. And it is maybe like couching it more in the idea of like a messiah complex than a like a racial one specifically, because obviously this is a film that has white actors playing brown characters, you know, like it is maybe not thinking in those terms. But I think that you can draw a pretty straight line between the, you know, the white savior figure and the messiah figure who is in a situation where he is the only white person.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing I would say, and again, we're talking about the second part of Dune a little bit, but I think we can hint at the fact that in both films, things don't quite go quite as planned. You know, I don't even necessarily think of them as white saviors without it being extremely complicated by what actually happens and by mm-hmm. the result of their actions and by the result of their immersion into a culture that is not their own. You know, I mean, these two films track on that front so closely together, you know, that again, you kind of regret that you're not seeing the full Dune here yet. But, you know, at least it's complicated in that way. At least it's not just about Paul or Lawrence coming and, you know, being the great leader that lifts us outside, this culture outside to him up, that, you know, that lifts them from oppression. It's a lot more complicated than that. You know, it's part of what makes, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, a great and rich film.
I think one of the big complications there is just the degree to which both of these movies make the culture that the white savior is supposedly uplifting the benighted nomads into look pretty repulsive. You know, the British snobbery in Lawrence of Arabia, their outright racism, their colonialism and paternalism all stands out pretty sharply. And the way they treat Lawrence and look down on him and don't like him when he's trying to fit in and hate him even more when he's not trying to fit in. Like, all of that is a pretty severe judgment against the culture he comes from. And in the same sort of way, the Imperium certainly does not model behavior that the Fremen are supposed to imitate in any way or aspire to. So there's definitely like less of a sense here. I don't know. I just got out of a period of reading like this gigantic compilation of Rudyard Kipling stories. And one of the things that I just struggled with over and over is that as interesting and good of a storyteller he is, that whole era in British thought was just so ingrained with colonialist racism and just the assumption that, like, of course, the British way is modern and civilized and all other ways are backwards and dumb and everybody has to be fixed. And I can see Lawrence edging up to that and then just kind of saying, like, no, these people are terrible. Why would you want to be like them? It almost feels like one of the reasons Lawrence is stuck between the two worlds is that he can see the deep-seated faults of both worlds, and he kind of recoils from both of them. He lives in a bit of a plane of purity and idealism where he wants everybody to operate in a certain way that literally nobody operates in, including often himself when he doesn't live up to his own expectations.
Yeah, I think if we're talking about this, we have to bring in the end of Lawrence of Arabia and what happens in Damascus and the Arab Council, you know, and the British sort of leaving them to figure this shit out. And like, it's definitely indicated that the British assume this is going to happen, that this tribal infighting is going to result in all of this falling apart, and they just kind of like sit back and let it happen. And then you get that scene where we see all the dead in Damascus, and then the British like kind of sort of like, see, this is what happens when savages fight or something, you know. It's all, like you said, Tasha, paternalistic, and like the attitudes carried into the resolution of this battle, I think, are, they're gross. you know, they're certainly of the era.
I think part of the thing that we end up getting in both of these movies out of that problematic dynamic where, you know, our putative white savior is trying to lead people in a direction that maybe they know is not the best direction to lead people in, is that both of these movies end up playing pretty strongly with the reluctant messiah trope. both of these characters take up the banner of leadership in certain ways, but both of them have second thoughts about it. And we don't get to see how Paul's fully plays out. We just see his deep-seated crisis in the tent, where he realizes the degree to which his life has been planned and programmed, and the degree to which his breeding has made him into something apart from what he thinks of as normal human life. With Lawrence, we see him go back and forth and back and forth in I don't want to do this anymore. I have to continue doing this kind of mode. But both of these stories, you know, give our heroes feet of clay and give them almost like panic responses to the level of responsibility that they're being asked to take on and the level of faith other people have in them. Both of them have moments where they just don't want that responsibility. And feel themselves unequal to the task. And it's just an interesting comparison in both cases. I don't know, compared to the stoic and emotionless heroes that I'm so tired of in other movies.
Again, I have to come back to Dawood and Faraj, the orphans, and how Lawrence like initially is like, no, I don't need servants. I can't afford servants. Like, he doesn't see himself as a great man who, you know, needs, I think slaves is actually what they call them, not servants. But, you know, he has to like basically be convinced, and it has to be presented to him in a context of saving these poor orphans, you know, as we discussed in the first half, you know, that the way that plays out for him is certainly rich and complicated and tragic.
You bring up Dawood Faraj and the kind of key characters in a way, in the sense that they initially benefit from Lawrence and his arrival and the and in British aid in general, and then ultimately it brings about both their deaths in fairly horrific fashions for both of them. There is a theme in both of these where outsiders coming in are disruptive and unwelcomed, but then it gets complicated. But, you know, I think sort of the ugliness we talked about in terms of the British culture here is, you know, one thing you can do with science fiction, of course, is run with these things. And the Harkonnens and not so much the Atreides, they're more of like sort of a, you know, there's nothing quite so ugly about them so much as there's fearfulness about their arrival, but the Harkonnens or Harkonnens, to use the Villeneuve pronunciation, are unreservedly ugly in ways that kind of give a perhaps appropriate face to colonialism.
Yeah, these are both very the battle against colonialism narratives. And I think they're both ultimately, as a result, kind of stories about somebody coming out of a corrupt old society, having a vision of a less corrupt new society. You know, Lawrence's big ideal is like Arab rule for Arab rule, like basically Arab rule for Arabs. Mm-hmm. And the idea that like all of these fractious tribes could bond together into this new society, which he tries to create in an image that he's seen for himself. And it just doesn't work out. You know, the society that he wants is not the culture that they live by. And sort of one man's dream can't really, I'm having Tucker, a man in his dream flashbacks now, but like one man's dream can't reshape thousands of years of culture overnight. And he seems almost hurt when that doesn't work out. And in the same sort of way, again, we're not getting to where Dune goes, and part two may complicate this, but what we have at least is the ideal of here's the old society that abused and enslaved you and killed you for no reason. Here's our new society that we're trying to forge, where you're respected and honored individuals who are allowed your own freedom and your own self-governance. Like, both of these stories are about heroes who have an ideal, and the ideal is expressly, here's where I came from. I don't like it. Let's do better in the new world.
I think there's something to be said, too, with Lawrence of Arabia about where power actually lies, you know, because so much of the film takes place in the desert, but the real decisions, you know, and I think Prince Faisal is involved in this, too, are made on by around desks, you know, still. That for all of the toil and death and effort that it's taken to try to you know, reshape the world, that, that ultimately these are decisions and deals that are struck around a desk. And so those kind of, so that the order of the already powerful is kind of restored. They kind of close rank together. You know, and I think there's, and I think in Dune, there's kind of a suspicion, an interesting suspicion that Stilgar, the Javier Bardem character and leader of the Fremen, brings to, you know, the scene with Duke Leto, where he's not, you know, Duke Leto wants to work in concert against, you know, what we certainly know are grosser, uglier forms of evil. But it's not like, you know, I mean, the House Atreides is still part of that Imperium. It, you know, and mining spice is still important, you know, that, and that, that's not necessarily the agenda that ultimately the Fremen are going to be into either.
If Dune was a very different story than it is, that confrontation with Stilgar coming in to meet the Atreides, I just kept thinking about like other stories we've seen about, you know, particularly in the West, the government perpetually making deals with the natives and then going back on them the second they wanted some land or they found a resource. And that whole meetup, like you can feel Stilgar's contempt for the whole process. And it's it's impossible to blame him for it, you know, because you know full well if he said, well, what we want is for you to never enter this area of land. And then they found out that that's the richest place to mine spice. Like that treaty would go out the window in no time. There's no reason for him to have respect for a process that he's seen historically has no respect for him.
Right.
And you kind of get the same deal with the Arabs around the table at the end of Lawrence. It's like, why would we participate in this when it's not giving us what we want or what we need, when it's just an endless frustration?
Well, you know, we've gotten about an hour into this conversation and, you know, we've definitely alluded to maybe the biggest connection between these two films. But I don't think we've actually dug into, hey, these both take place in a desert, you know, which is a very...
Whoa. I know. You're right.
Yeah, Keith had not seen that up until now. It is a little obscure when you think about it.
But, you know, the desert is a very evocative landscape, both visually and thematically. You know, it's kind of a counterpoint to the sea, which we talked about in feedback in part one, too, is having this sort of like mysterious, lethal power that, you know, and in Dune in particular, I feel like the sandworms kind of make the whole idea of the desert as sea even more explicit. But I think maybe we just can start with the visual aspect of the desert in both of these films. I brought up in the first half Lawrence of Arabia's signature shot of just the flat, empty landscape with a tiny figure on the horizon. And the film certainly leans into the wide open, clean, empty aridness of it. Dune's desert, I feel, is like maybe a little more active. You know, obviously you have the sandworms, but also, you know, you have dunes and you know, it's just, and part of it is the way it's filmed too. It's just a lot more of I don't want to necessarily say it's more dynamic, because obviously Lawrence of Arabia is very dynamic visually, but the desert in Dune, I think it just feels like it has more, a little more life to it, as it were.
Well, there are different deserts in Lawrence of Arabia, and that's one of the fascinating things, because we do start out with desert scenes in Lawrence that have dunes, because I found myself just thinking this isn't an effect. This is a real place. This is what parts of the desert look like. This is a place that I'm never going to be physically, that I'm just looking at right now with my own eyes. So just, you know, one of those things that you maybe forget about cinema and then rediscover a thousand times over. But when they head out into God's Anvil and it's just white and flat as far as the eye can see, and there's literally nothing there. The fact that they travel there and then they come to a place that's like sand and a few small rocks and a few small like grayish bushes, and it looks like the lushest place imaginable after where they've been. It's like, oh, thank goodness they're out of the desert and into this place that's just made out of sand and rocks. You know, both of these movies very definitely focused on vistas, on like vast, intimidating, lands that dwarf humanity and could swallow humanity without a trace and without a hope, as metaphor, as symbol, but also just as like overwhelmingly kind of powerful and beautiful images.
I mean, if you're looking for kind of a connection here, or a Villeneuve signature, it's landscapes. You know, one thing that you do notice in so many of the films that he's made is he loves to establish the topography of a place. He loves these really big, incredible, like overhead shots of like, you think of like the borderlands of Sicario or, you know, this kind of like,
Blade Runner does it. Blade Runner 2049 has a whole desert.
That's all. That's like all that film is. Yeah. Is that stuff. You know, even a film like Prisoners, which is not set in a desolate landscape, but is set, you know, in a middle class community, has a kind of a dark grandeur that is sort of brought out in wide shot. And so this is something. This is kind of his mode of making movies, and so it kind of makes him, you know, ideal to make Dune and to give the world of Arrakis a texture to it that is both exotic and dangerous at the same time and imposing, but also kind of home to people. There are actually people who do live there and consider it home. So, you know, there's a purpose behind, you know, the visuals there. And I think there's a lot, you know, I'd be interested to see if someone do some kind of visual essay about, you know, that particular impulse on Villeneuve's part to give you that wide kind of overhead shot of the landscape, and him finding that to be an important kind of establishing piece of the worlds that he, you know, ends up exploring.
I do think it's interesting that in both cases, like what you're talking about in terms of the imposingness of the desert, in both of these films, like the Fremen and the Bedouin are both characterized very similarly in that they're capable of surviving this environment and being comfortable in it and calling it home. Like they've adapted to live in the place that's unlivable. And in both cases, you're kind of told these are tough, badass warriors who move astonishingly quickly in places where most people can't survive. You know, they're capable and experienced and dangerous, but you almost don't need to be told that. You know, these are people who are capable of surviving in this. And we're just going to spend a lot of time looking at this and imagining what it would be like to live there. Just the fact that they're not only still alive, but thriving says so much about, you know, both of them as groups.
And when it also says on the reverse of that, for colonialists, it's like these are just, you know, shitholes, basically. Oh, these are horrible places, you know, godforsaken places that they would have absolutely nothing to do with if there wasn't something they could just like take from the earth, you know, they can just grab from it, that they can claim to be theirs, you know. So it is a really interesting contrast between those two things. And, yeah, and that kind of, you know, go ahead.
Well, just a little point of comparison between another connection between the two of them is the sort of space that the colonizers carve out, whether it's the palace that the Atreides live in or the very exclusive officers club that you know, you have to be, you cannot, not even all white people are involved or are allowed to come inside. You have to be an officer as well.
And they plant palm trees, right? Or were the palm trees already there in Dune?
The palm trees are there.
Okay.
But they get watered. And that's a kind of a controversial thing to do on a planet where water is extremely hard to come by.
Yeah.
It's an indulgence to have these palm trees in front.
Yeah. But they look so cool when they go up in flames.
And so symbolically loaded when they go up in flames.
Yeah, exactly.
Like even the Harkonnens like respected the sacredness of these palm trees, which is really saying something given the Harkonnens. But you know, this war spares no palm trees, no children, no families, no palm trees. I guess just in general, we should talk about the scope of these movies and the difference between making an epic back then, which necessarily involved, no, we're going to troop out to the desert and live there for a year. We're going to assemble 1,000 horse riders and camel riders and put them out on the field and have them like run into the city. We have to physically do most of the things that you're seeing on screen versus, I don't know if you saw, I think it was Guillermo del Toro interviewed Villeneuve and was talking about just the scope of some of the stuff and like asking how you shot it. It was specifically asking, like, how the hell he shot the sandworm and got that effect. And Villeneuve was like, I hate to tell you this, but it's all digital. It's all special effects. Mm-hmm. And Del Toro was sounded kind of floored. but so much
What did he think?
I don't know. I don't know.
That would be the largest sphincter in human history.
I assume that he was thinking
some models,
maybe miniatures. Like, yeah. I could see getting that effect. Like, the sandworms in Lynch's Dune are, I think, really quite impressive. But maybe he was just thinking in terms of a smaller version of that, as opposed to an entirely special effects driven one. But in both of these movies, you know, you get that sense of distance and scope and weight. You just get it through very, very different means.
Yeah, one of the places I get it in Lawrence of Arabia that I don't think we've talked much about yet is just the animals, like specifically the camels and also the horses. You know, like, there are just a lot of live animals in this film. And like, camels are cool, man. Like, I never really like paid enough attention to camels before this movie. But like, they're just like very interesting on-screen presences. And I'm also thinking of one of the train scenes where all the horses like leap off the train, like, that wasn't digital, you know, like, that really happened. And, you know, I do wonder how safely it happened for all the animals. I did a little light Googling to see if there was any sort of harm to animals associated with this film, and I couldn't find anything too notorious. But, you know, it feels like, you know, it probably could have happened and no one, you know, really thought much about it at that point in time. But, it
wasn't necessarily an era where they were tracking such things.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, the tools with which you can suggest bigness, you know, in epicness, it, of course, have changed quite substantially between Lawrence of Arabia and Dune. And with Dune, I think you get, I mean, with Lawrence of Arabia, of course, you've got the large format, you've got the real locations, you have real stuff happening in front of the camera, real extras. You know, it's just the scale of that production is very huge and very practical in a way. You don't need to do that or even necessarily want to do that for something like Dune. But some of the things that Villeneuve does here are done through sound. You know, so much of the bigness of Dune, I mean, apart from the effects, which really give you like the ornithopters and stuff. I mean, that stuff is really cool. I mean, and the structures are really cool and they're just larger than you could ever conceive. But just the way sound reinforces all of that, just the bone rattling soundtrack before you even get to the Hans Zimmer score, kind of just makes everything that's already large seem that much more imposing. And also kind of gives a weight in a way to effects, you know, because that's the big problem with effects. Too many computer effects is that it's like, this is all plastic. This doesn't have any feel gritty at all. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, Dune could potentially be a film that where the desert doesn't feel textured in any way. It feels completely like something that's come on that's like, you know, built on a computer, and it doesn't have that. It has real weight to it.
I agree that it has real weight, and I agree that it's really well done in terms of, like, I did actually kind of feel the weight of when the ships are exploding on the launch pad, when you're watching these vast transport ships go up in flames before the crews can even get to them. You feel the size and weight of that loss and kind of the heat of the flames. Where I kind of lose the sense of epic scope with something like Dune is in the crowds of people, because it's so easy compared to some other things they do in special effects. I don't want to be one of these people that are like, oh, there's a computer button you press that does that. But it's comparatively easy and has been done for a comparatively long time now to just kind of clone stamp armies. So when you have things like the vast Atreides army all standing behind the Duke waiting for the announcement from the Herald, or the Sadakar army kneeling in the rain or what have you, my mind no longer goes to, oh my gosh, this is so epic. Like, they got 1,000 people for this. It just kind of goes to a place of, huh, I wonder if that's 3 guys or 4, you know, before they started playing with the digital effects. But then you see an equivalent crowd in Lawrence of Arabia, and there's just a sense of, oh my God, so many costumes, so many camels, so much wrangling.
so many people like extremely well paid for their services.
Oh dear. let's not even think about that, let alone how many of those horses broke legs.
Before we leave the subject of camels, O'Toole has a really funny line in interviews where he talks about how no one really rides a camel. You just kind of get on a camel and hope it goes where you want it to go. Also, apparently those were wood saddles on the camels.
Oh, ooh. Yeah, they looked incredibly rough. Uncomfortable. Yeah. It's two poles and you sit in between them and try not to fall off. But there is, to circle back briefly to camels are cool, there is that scene where I can't remember if it's Daud or Farage who like waits on the edge of the desert just watching for Lawrence to reappear. And when he does, whichever one of them it is, starts running the camel toward them. And you get, you know, just 20 uncut David Lean minutes of watching every pace that a camel has, which is interesting if you've ever seen like the Muybridge photos of how a horse runs. It's a very different gait depending on whether it's like a trot or a gallop or a walk or what have you. Like the legs do different things. Seeing that same thing in a camel as it goes through each of its separate paces, like seeing how those weird knobby stick legs move across the desert is just surreal. And I can't help but feel that Lean spent so much time with that just because it's kind of incredible to watch a camel run and to watch somebody trying to hang on to it while it runs.
Kind of like a sandworm, right?
I don't think it's fun to watch a sandworm gallop. I don't think that's why David Lean didn't spend any time on sandworm galloping. Well, we really need to wrap this up and move on. I will just say briefly, without diving deep into it, that both of these movies put a lot of emphasis on the first kill mm-hmm. a young man has, the first time that he has to commit murder for what he believes in, and the fear that he's going to develop a taste for it.
I think Paul will probably be fine, right? That won't play into part two at all. Well, it's not like it was a climactic part of the movie or anything, right? He was fine with it.
It's certainly not like he's been just dreaming obsessively and incessantly about knives and blood. I don't think it's ever going to come up again. I think we're pretty much done with it. Much as with in Lawrence, he worries that, you know, he's becoming inured to violence and then there's no violence for the rest of the film and it's all just fine. So just another way these two movies are alike in the way that they just kind of gloss over that theme and never return to it again. If you want to return to these movies again, Lawrence of Arabia is on DVD and Blu-ray. It's widely streaming on rental services and on-demand cable services. It's a big classic. It's pretty easy to find, real cheap in whatever format you want. Dune is in theaters and on HBO Max. Frankly, I'm going to say if you're watching this one at home, you're missing out on a lot of the reason to see it. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time for your next picture show, which we're retooling a bit, given how much the film and TV worlds have been bleeding into each other lately. We're watching films at home alongside our TV, we're watching TV that feels like film, and we're watching TV by filmmakers and films by TV figures. So we're just going to ask everybody, what would you recommend watching right now? Genevieve?
Oh, well, look, I'm going to recommend a TV show, but one produced by executive produced by a director we have spoken about on this podcast before. And for what it's worth, you know, all eight episodes laid end to end is about the same runtime as Lawrence of Arabia. I'm speaking of season one of the FX series Reservation Dogs, which recently wrapped its eight 22 minute episodes. But despite that little factoid about it being as long as Lawrence of Arabia, like this is not a movie in eight parts. This is a TV show. This is episodic television. One of the things I really love about this show and this season is its structure. If you don't know Reservation Dogs, it's a comedy series created by Taika Waititi alongside Sterling Harjo. It's basically an all indigenous production. It has like the largest indigenous writers room in history and all indigenous cast. It takes place, you know, on a reservation in Oklahoma, and it stars four really great young indigenous actors as the four central friends in the story. And like, it starts out in its first few episodes is almost sort of just like a hangout comedy. You know, it's very low key. You kind of like bop around the reservation with these four friends as they are basically trying to get money together to leave for California. And that's sort of like the table setting. But then as it progresses, you get like episodes that focus on each of the four, and they all kind of tie into the larger arc of the season. But, you know, you get these four different character showcases, and then it comes together in a really, I think, elegant way at the end. So just as like episodic television, it's really well done. It's a just like sort of a vibey show. It's got so many like great colorful supporting characters. I really loved Reservation Dogs, and you know, I won't tell you too much more about it because I think it's a show that's definitely, you know, better experienced than told about. So I would definitely recommend. It's on FX on Hulu. So if you have Hulu, you can watch it all there. And it has already been greenlit for a second season. So I'm really excited to see it come back for more. So yeah, Reservation Dogs.
I have been so excited to dig into that. I've heard such good things about it. And I love Taika Waititi's stories and just the places that he chooses to tell stories, which this just seems to fit into so well. Genevieve, I had seen the news about it being renewed for season two. Like, do you feel that the first season tells a complete story, or does it tease its way into there's more of the story to come in season two?
I mean, it definitely tells a complete story in terms of like the friendship of these characters. And I don't want to like, there's sort of a central event that is defining their friendship that I don't really want to get into, but it kind of like brings resolution to that event in the first season. But there, it also breaks open the quartet in a way that opens the door for a second season and sort of a new story, you know, because obviously we can't, I don't think they're going to just like repeat the arc of the first season. And just again, like the four young leads are all so good and fun to watch. So that alone, I think, would be reason enough to come back for a season two.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but great things about that show.
Yeah.
Same.
If you can watch Lawrence of Arabia, you can watch Reservation Dogs. Tasha, what about you?
Well, does Reservation Dogs have a built-in intermission, though, is the important thing.
Yes, it has seven of them in between each episode.
Oh, that's convenient.
You can wait like a whole week before watching the next one if you want to. Television's funny that way. Sorry.
Well, speaking of things that have built-in intermissions between episodes, the thing that I was going to recommend is, it's called Maya and the Three. As we're recording this, it's about to debut on Netflix. It'll be out by the time people listen to this. It is a complete 9-episode series. The episodes run about half an hour, from Jorge R. Gutierrez, who is the director, creator of the movie The Book of Life. If people remember that animated film, it was just a really distinctive and unusual animated movie back in 2014. And I want to say 3 years ago at this point, I went on a tour of Netflix's headquarters in LA, and he was hard at work on this series. And it was one of the most exciting things I saw while I was there. They had just these character breakdowns and world breakdowns covering the walls. And I was drooling for it to come out. And then just years of silence went by. And I'd started to think that it had been entirely scrapped. But once I first had the opportunity to see it, it became clear why it took so long. So this is about a 4.5-hour story, but it's one big continuous story. It feels like a long movie. And it takes up some of the themes of Book of Life, some of the feeling of Book of Life. This is a movie that kind of mashes together Mesoamerican myth, Incan, Mayan, Aztec, like all together into this great big gigantic fable about a girl who believes that her family has been prophesied to fight and defeat the gods of the underworld, the dark gods. This is a very supernaturally tinged world full of mayhem and adventure and magic. And when things don't exactly work out the way she was expecting for the prophecy, she has to go on this epic quest and create a group built up of outsiders who aren't what she expects. And, you know, it's kind of a kid's story. It follows kind of like big familiar patterns. But this movie, it's CG animation that really brought home to me like how much we've come to expect CG animation to look like a certain thing. In the same way, animation in America in particular from like roughly the 50s through the 80s all kind of tried to follow the Disney pattern. It was expected that movies, animated movies, would look a certain way because you were kind of trying to chase the Disney movie money and maybe delude people into thinking you were a Disney movie. In the same kind of way, for a long time now, CG animation has all kind of adopted the same visual models. Like the details will vary, but there's just a certain quality of product that you see over and over. Maya and the Three is very heavily inflected around Mesoamerican culture, Mesoamerican fashion, Mesoamerican art and culture. And it just does not look like anything else out there. For somebody trained on American animation, it may kind of take a while for your eyes to adjust. But I love the characters. I love the story. It goes to a place that's really unexpected for people used to American animation stories in particular. It's got a pretty amazing cast. Zoe Saldana, Danny Trejo, Rita Moreno, Gael Garcia Bernal, Queen Latifah, Alfred Molina, Diego Luna, Rosie Perez, just on and on and on. There are a bunch more. I don't want to read the IMDb to you, but it's a huge celebration of like Mexican Spanish heritage as a whole, and Mesoamerican culture and history, like all kind of wrapped up into this one very accessible, like fun, interesting, really kind of weird story. So I've been waiting quite a while for this, and it did not disappoint me. It surprised me a lot. It definitely skews toward the young side of things, but it's both good to watch with your kids and just fun, I think, for animation fans. So that's Maya and the Three on Netflix. It should be all available now. I really don't think there's going to be a second season because of where the story goes, but who knows? Scott, what about you?
But I'm just wondering if we're a movie podcast anymore. What's with all the TV?
What even is movies? What even is TV? What even is time?
Okay, so well, in that spirit, I will say, you know, just sit right back and you'll hear a tale, a tale of a fateful trip to Bergman Island. I'm not talking about Bergman Island. You thought I have a whole song. I actually write out a whole
verse. We specifically scrapped a Bergman Island pairing just so Scott wouldn't do that song.
I found a workaround.
He's irrepressible. There is no repressing him.
No repressing. So I wanted to talk about Mia Hansen-Love's new film called Bergman Island, which is quite lovely. It stars Tim Roth and Vicky Creeps, who you know from Phantom Thread, as filmmakers who are a couple, much like the filmmakers Mia Hansen-Love and Olivier Assayas, who go to Faro, which is the island. It's called Bergman Island because Bergman resided there for decades and made many important works there, including Scenes from a Marriage and Persona and plenty of other Bergman classics. And so it's a very elusive film. The two of them end up staying in sleeping in the same bed that Scenes from a Marriage, it was from Scenes of a Marriage. And of course, they have a somewhat shaky relationship, which is really not what you want to bring into that space, I wouldn't think. But this is a fascinating movie. I mean, it's about these two characters who are on somewhat separate tracks, or have different sensibilities as filmmakers. Tim Roth is, you know, making these genre films. He's already, you know, highly acclaimed. There's a screening of one of his films at one point. You know, people are showing up for like a master class. Vicky Creeps' character is a little bit less certain of herself. The writing process for her, unlike him, is much more tortured. And just the kind of separate trajectories of their careers and their processes cause a lot of tension, very interesting tensions in the movie. But those tensions are not handled as they would be in a Bergman film. Her sensibility and Bergman's sensibility are nothing alike. And you end up, and of course, in Faroe Island, through the lens of Bergman, of the film Bergman Island, it looks impossible that there could be conflict of the an austerity of the level that you expect from Ingmar Bergman. It is a beautiful place, and there's even kind of almost like a Napa Valley like tour of the island that you could take a Bergman tour where you could do various see various locations. Any case, it's a lovely movie. You know, it's got some interesting, it's got a lot of fun sort of Bergman arcana. And then it really kind of comes to life in this movie within a movie where Vicky Creeps kind of describes the story that she wants to tell. And the story involves Mia Wasikowska. And when that layer is added to it, and this film is nothing but a film of many lovely, multi-layers, it really kind of comes to life for me. I think it's a tremendous achievement from a filmmaker who really is interested in, it folds in well with her other work too, films like Goodbye First Love especially. So I highly recommend it. It's IFC Films, so it's kind of trickling about the country in independent theaters, but I'm sure it'll find its way somewhere that people can access no matter where they are, but not quite yet. So I just look for it at your local art house if you can, because it is a terrific movie. Bergman Island. Keith?
I also have a film, although it'll be a film that could only be watched on a streaming service. And I'm a couple years behind on this one.
Six Underground?
Yeah, absolutely that. Six Underground. No, it's a film that at the time people were talking about, oh, hey, it's good. It's too bad no one's watching it. And people, there's nobody's watching it, including the people who should have been watching it that weren't, included me. That's a film called The Report, starring Adam Driver. I watched it because I was writing a piece on Adam Driver. That's a big Adam Driver film I had not seen. Mm-hmm. It is directed by Scott Z. Burns. It is the true story of a report being prepared about the torture by the CIA during the war on terror. And Driver plays Daniel Jones, a dogged investigator determined to see the report through stuck in a system that doesn't necessarily want it to all this to come to light for various reasons. People people on the Republican side, people part of the Bush administration, people part of the Obama administration. It is really quite well done. It's a really great Driver performance, and it is a depressing dramatization of how hard it is to get anything done inside a democracy, frankly, even when you have allies who ostensibly want the same thing, it may not be politically expedient to pursue that. So it's relevant about a very particular issue, but I think it's also kind of relevant about how politics are done in general. And it is on Amazon Prime, and it is worth your time.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It was so buried and forgotten about, almost in a way that was like depressingly apropos.
Yeah.
That here's a film that works incredibly hard with incredible diligence to present the details of the story about someone who works hard and incredibly diligently to bring you something this urgent.
Yeah.
And in both cases completely buried, but really, really good movie if you haven't seen it.
It came out at around the same time as Marriage Story and Star Wars, mm-hmm. The Rise of Skywalker. And it's kind of like, we don't have room for a third Adam Driver movie in our hearts at the end of 2019. But I do hope people will get around to discovering it in time. And that's The Report. It's on Amazon Prime, directed by Scott Z. Burns.
Well, thank you for all of that. I will say that our intended pivot to, hey, it's okay to watch TV too, has an unexpected downside, which is we're assigning people even more hours of viewing than we already had before. So thank you for giving everybody so much homework. And that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing is November 9 and 16. Scott, what do we have on tap?
The new Edgar Wright film, Last Night in Soho, pays homage to dozens of inspirations, from giallo classics like Suspiria and Blood and Black Lace to British horror films like Peeping Tom and The Innocents. But its story about women from two different time periods whose stories and personalities gradually converge recalled for us the great Ingmar Bergman masterpiece Persona from 1966. In the first of 10 collaborations with Bergman, Liv Ullmann stars as a stage actress who just suddenly stops speaking or moving in the middle of a performance. Bibi Anderson plays a young nurse who is asked to take care of her at her doctor's seaside retreat, under the hope that the peaceful locale will help the actress recuperate. But the psychological friction that results is anything but peaceful. On our next set of episodes, we'll be converging two time periods of our own, by bringing Persona and Last Night in Soho together and seeing double twice. Please join us.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Lawrence of Arabia, Dune, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith and Scott, do you want to do this jointly at this point?
Sure, why not?
All right, you say one word, then I'll say the next word, and then we'll do it that way.
Well, we're being paired, as listeners know, because Scott and I have a newsletter called The Reveal. It's at thereveal.substack.com, and it's a nice focus for a lot of our writing, reviews, essays, etc. It's a lot of fun. I'm still having fun. How about you, Scott?
I'm not ready to murder you yet.
And beyond that, for my sake, you can find me on Twitter at kfips3000, and you can find a lot of my writing at places like GQ, Vulture, and TV Guide. Scott, how about you? Where can we find you besides thereveal.substack.com? Well,
people should smash that subscribe button. I get to say that now. Smash that subscribe button. You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and I'm still incredibly doing the same amount of, if not more, freelance work that I was doing before. I'm not sleeping much. I'm writing for Vulture, I'm writing for the New York Times, and writing for The Guardian and other places as well. Genevieve?
I am the senior TV editor at Vulture, where I assign people like Scott and Keith to write about TV sometimes. Scott,
I like it. There's a place for it.
And you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Koski. Tasha,
I just want to say, when they say they're doing a lot of writing at The Reveal, they are not kidding, man. I have been getting these daily bulletins, and there's so much.
We took one day off.
It feels like being back at the Dissolve again. I'm like, I don't know how you guys are keeping up. Apparently not by sleeping.
Yeah, no, things will slow down. We'll get there.
I am the film and television editor, soon to be the film and streaming editor, because next week we're bringing in a TV editor, a full-time TV editor, at Polygon.com, where we're about to do a similar exhausting deluge of content for the last week of Halloween on horror tropes. And I would urge everybody to tune in and check up on our extensive breakdown of all of the tropes in horror. I'm currently writing a piece about why horror is the tropiest genre that you'll ever know. And you can imagine what song has been running through my head for the past several days. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net and via Twitter at nextpicturepod. You can contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it, and please consider rating and reviewing us, which will help other people find your very favorite podcast in the entire world.
And it makes us happy.
There's that too. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes, who also makes us happy with his assistance in producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.